Welcome to Groundwire, the national news program of Campus and Community Radio in Canada. Today's hosts are Selena Wall and Frieda Worden from CJSF Radio at Simon Fraser University, Burnaby, BC. We'll be looking back at some of the hottest stories of 2013, including resource extraction and the Bedford prostitution case. First, our headlines. In December, whistleblower Edward Snowden told mainstream media that his goal has already been accomplished. That is, he opened up the mass surveillance practices of the U.S. National Security Agency to public scrutiny. In that process, he also exposed spying activities by Canada, which helps the U.S. with surveillance in more than 20 countries. Based on Snowden's revelation, Brazil has launched a complaint against Canada for spying on its mining and energy industries. Canada also approved mass spying by the U.S. within Canada during the 2010 G8 and G20 summits, which may have played a role in the vast number of protester arrests. Although the head of CSEC claims the agency is forbidden to spy on Canadians or to ask other countries to spy on Canadians, more than 30 Canadian organizations united in October to form a Protect Our Privacy coalition. They are calling on stronger oversight of CSEC and legal protection for the public against mass surveillance. Two members of the coalition, OpenMedia.ca and the BC Civil Liberties Association, have filed suit against the government, seeking assurance that security forces don't make mass collections of private data, but only target specific criminal activities. Civil society groups from across the Americas, including Canada, are also raising the mass global communications surveillance issue at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and the Organization of American States.
On December 19th, the Supreme Court of Canada released a ruling that will curtail police impunity. In the Wood v. Schaefer ruling, 6 out of 9 Supreme Court judges agreed that allowing police officers to consult with lawyers prior to filing their reports following an act of violence by a police officer impedes justice and prevents transparency. When police officers consult with lawyers before preparing their notes, it shifts the focus from accurately recording the event as it happened to justifying the actions of the officer. Don Paley of the Media Co-op interviewed Ruth Schaefer, a victim's mother. Schaefer said, "There is no way of me procuring any justice for my son. It's not going to happen. There is absolutely no venue in this society to get any justice for my son. My son was shot and killed 4 years ago where there were no witnesses. And although I believe, based on the testimony of the police officers involved at the inquest, there was absolutely no need for him to be killed, there is nothing I can do about it." Schaefer gave up her right to sue in order for this case to be heard at the Supreme Court. "I'm very pleased that the Supreme Court of Canada came down with this particular ruling," she added. "It is historical, and it means that it will be the first time in Canadian history that the citizenry of the country can have at least some degree of belief that the police are not keeping two sets of notes, and they're not getting help from a lawyer to write those notes."
No other public broadcaster in any free and democratic country in the world faces such interference with its editorial independence as what is proposed in Bill C-60.
One of the events that generated activism in 2013 was the introduction of Clause 228 into Bill C-60, the Harper government's comprehensive budget bill. This was described by the group Friends of Canadian Broadcasting as an attack on the independence of the CBC. Ian Morrison is that group's spokesperson.
Back in April, an industrious reporter found something insidious buried on page 109 of the government's omnibus budget bill. It was a sneaky measure to give Stephen Harper control over the wages and working conditions of all CBC staff, including thousands of journalists who cover the news. We immediately launched a campaign website in cooperation with our partner, Lead Now.
In this promotional video, Morrison says that within a week, more than 130,000 people had signed the web petition to remove Clause 228 from the budget bill. The matter came to a vote in Parliament, and all three opposition parties voted 100% in favor of deleting the clause, but the Conservative majority voted 100% against deleting, so it remained in the final Bill C-60 as passed on June 10th. While the CBC is not specifically named, what Clause 228 does is expand the role of the Treasury Board, the parliamentary committee that takes part in collective bargaining with civil service employees, and of course is controlled by the ruling party. Under the new bill, the Treasury Board now takes part in collective bargaining within all Crown corporations, and also must approve the terms and conditions of employment of non-unionized employees. The CBC is one of the federal Crown corporations, so a window is open for government interference. After C-60 passed, Friends of Canadian Broadcasting launched a comic TV ad of a man confronting Harper.
Mr. Prime Minister, your critics say that you have taken control of the CBC and that you've undermined the arm's-length relationship between our national public broadcaster and the federal government. How do you respond to that?
At this point, two thugs grab the man and stuff him in the trunk of a car.
There goes my Senate appointment.
Who is going to ask the tough questions now?
This ad aired on only a few TV stations. Among those that rejected it was the CBC. However, it was widely viewed online. Morrison says of its effectiveness.
So far, we have deterred Harper from using his new powers to undermine CBC's independence.
For more about the campaign, look for Friends of Canadian Broadcasting online.
In the past year, there has been a lot of discussion surrounding resource extraction, production, and transportation in Canada, with movements such as Idle No More leading the way in protesting Canada's seemingly diminishing environmental standards. The Northern Gateway Pipeline is seen by many as a bastion of the federal government's devotion to promoting the idea of resource extraction as the best way to fuel Canada's economy. And on December 19th, a joint federal review panel announced its tentative support of the pipeline project with 209 conditions only. However, given the protests that have taken place over the past year and the many people and groups who still stand in opposition to this pipeline and other mining and fracking projects, it's clear that this debate will continue well into 2014 and beyond. One of the most interesting aspects of these protests and discussions is the way that Aboriginal Canadians have been leading this cause. We see it all over the country, in everywhere from New Brunswick, where there was an Aboriginal-led anti-fracking protest that gained national attention, to the continued refusal of Native communities in Western Canada to allow the Northern Gateway Pipeline to run through their land. In the spirit of New Year's and looking back, we will now play some of the most memorable clips of these types of stories that were covered by Groundwire during the year.
Mi'kmaq community members have been blocking roads in protest of seismic testing and tracking activities in their territory. Lorraine Clare describes arriving to the site where the trucks were on June 5th.
So a week ago, we decided we were going to go and confront and stop the thumper trucks that are on the Highway 126 here in Kent County. When we got there, it was just this vision of driving up there and seeing all of the those geophones and all of this equipment that the SWN has put out on our land was quite emotional. It was, I really felt for Mother Earth at that time. As Mi'kmaq women, we've been given the responsibility to protect the water, to protect the earth.
Later that day, Lorraine was violently arrested while praying during the ceremony.
I tried to walk past him to finish the song, to finish the other two directions. He stopped me again. He stood right in front of me. I was attempting to walk away from the trucks as they asked us. He stopped me and he started yelling. I continued to pray because the song, the ceremony was not over. So I continued to pray. I continued to sing. And all I remember is feeling his hand completely engulfed the top of my head and pushed me down and said, arrest this one. And after that, it was just a matter of hands coming at me, and I was completely surrounded.
Suzanne Paddles was also arrested that day while praying.
They're saying I committed mischief for laying tobacco down and praying after the police officers asked me to stay on this side of them. I did. I made the line and I made the circle and I was just going to do my prayer and leave. That was my plan and intention, just to lay my tobacco down. And I was just starting on my One Direction and I was just about to lift my tobacco up to Creator, and they continued to arrest me. I still had the tobacco in my hand.
On June 14th, 12 more people were arrested at a sunrise ceremony on Highway 126 in New Brunswick. Suzanne and Lorraine, with support from Mi'kmaq communities and allies, are continuing to raise awareness about the dangers of fracking.
Once you poison and pollute water, there's nothing you could do to bring it back to life, because water is sacred and it's a living thing.
Taking that tar sands out of that land is breaking that balance. And now they're coming to our territory, and they wanted to dig into our mother on this side. They want to break the balance here too. We're not going to allow it. We will stand united. We will stand proud Mi'kmaq women, and we will do what we need to do.
That story was produced by Carly Forbes with CFRU and released on Groundwire on June 17th. Our next clip is from a story produced by Chris Alabinsty from CFBX. This story was released on September 24th.
I'm standing in the crowd at the first public rally against the proposed Ajax mine. About 200 people are here, gathered on the steps of a building at Thompson Rivers University. The protest was moving along pretty typically when suddenly, out of nowhere, this happened. That was a black Hummer filled with Ajax supporters that rolled up to within inches of the crowd and started revving its engine. The act was largely ignored by the rest of the protest, but for those in the immediate area, I could tell a spark had been lit. I walked over. The first person I talked to was a man standing there with his daughter.
I don't know if these guys have thought what it's like, a bunch of big guys turning up with beer cans, smoking, shouting, driving a foot behind me with a vehicle.
Schools for your child. Where's that money going to come from? If it doesn't come from resource extraction, it's going to come from taxation, you and I.
This went on for a long time, both sides making points that the other thought was irrelevant to the issue. Since I was still sitting there, I walked over and talked to the driver of our infamous black Hummer that we heard earlier.
Can I get your name?
Gavin McGraw.
Are you a student here at TRU?
Yes, I am. Heavy duty mechanic.
So I guess I'll ask, why are you guys here?
To support Ajax, man.
Why do you support Ajax?
Because it creates jobs.
How many jobs do you think it'll create?
Oh, directly 500, indirectly thousands.
And how long?
No, they're not.
Guys, I'm trying to do an interview.
The shouting went on for a bit, but eventually we got back to the interview.
So how long do you think those jobs will last?
17 years, I'd say.
So you think you yourself will be employed for 17 years here in this area?
Yeah, I'm already employed at other mines here, and it's created tons of jobs, thousands. And then they'll find more mines. Exploration. Ground keeps rolling. How big the world is, you have no idea. How many mines can easily be created.
When you're considering these choices, are you considering mainly the economic impact that you yourself personally will benefit from? And do you consider it all sort of the environmental impacts that are out there? The impact that mining has on water and things like that?
All the positives completely override that, completely. No negative impacts on the environment. They're a mine. They professionally do their job. They all control all that, believe me.
So, apparently, the world's resources are infinite. There are no environmental impacts. And mining companies never screw up.
Our last clip is from another story produced by Carly Forbes, which was released to Groundwire on June 17th. A blockade at the Enbridge construction site along Line 9 at the Westover Pump Station took place starting last Thursday, June 20th. Byron, who is also a member of Guelph Anti-Pipeline Action, spoke about walking onto the site Thursday morning.
I think it was about 60 to 80 people walked on the site as workers at the site were just ending their shift. And before new workers came on, when we walked on, people handed out leaflets and flyers to all the workers there, and describing the situation, saying, you know, this isn't about you as workers. We respect y'all are trying to make a living. This is about Enbridge is a huge corporation, about capitalism and about environmental destruction, and like the further project of colonialism. There were some interesting conversations with Enbridge representatives There were conversations with the police, who threatened at first to kick everybody off immediately and that people wouldn't stay for longer than a couple of hours. But when folks, I guess from Six Nations and other folks representing different crews from across Ontario showed up, that the police sort of took a step back.
The blockade held for several days before being served an injunction on Tuesday morning. Meanwhile, solidarity demonstrations took place in 12 different cities across Canada. Shea describes the injunction and the arrests that were to follow.
It was a 3 or 4 page paper that said, you know, anybody who is not authorized by Enbridge is here, alerted that they should go, and that Enbridge is authorized to request police assistance in removing unauthorized people or equipment. And that sort of, yeah, that's sort of the gist of what the injunction was. And so as soon as we got served with it, we had a meeting, a camp meeting of, okay, so what's the next step? And we brought up the concern that the address on the injunction was wrong. So we handed it back to the police. We wanted a paper copy of the official injunction with the correct address. And that actually gave us more time to be on the site. The police ended up arriving in the middle of the night and then started arrests at about 7 o'clock in the morning, arresting not just people who were at the front gate, but also the police liaison who was down the street. So people weren't they were arresting people whether or not they were directly on the site. And then they moved in with construction equipment, including a backhoe, to take down the barricade and extract people from the lockdown.
20 people were arrested that morning, and these arrests come at the heels of the Hamilton police receiving over $44,000 from Enbridge recently. I'm Carly Forbes from Guelph Prison Radio, reporting for Groundwire.
On December 20th, 2013, a decision was released in Bedford versus Canada. In its decision, the Supreme Court struck down 3 provisions of Canada's prostitution laws related to brothel keeping, living off the avails of prostitution, and communicating for the purpose of selling sex. Groundwire has covered this case over the years as it progressed from the Ontario Superior Court to the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. Carly Forbes captured an appearance by the lead plaintiff at a Sex Workers' National Day of Action rally in Toronto in June, just before the Supreme Court started hearing the case.
Terry Jean Bedford is commonly called Canada's most famous dominatrix and has been in the news for many years fighting against our prostitution laws. Her business, the Bondage Bungalow, became the target of a spectacular raid and was shut down in 1994. After 6 years of highly publicized trials and appeals, she was convicted of body house laws. Terry Jean is one of the plaintiffs at the Supreme Court of Canada on June 13, 2013 in Ottawa.
Women are demonstrating for their freedom and safety. In Ottawa, next week, the highest judges in the land will give the final legal word on the despicable laws we now have. But whatever they say and rule, we know that no thinking person will believe that things can go on as they have before.
Can we get some noise from Terry Jean Bedford?
A number of organizations and coalitions were granted intervener status to give opinions during the court proceedings. Fred Chatbot from the sex worker group Power describes a moment.
Cynthia, our lawyer, told the court that not only is sex work not valued in society, sex workers are not valued. I mean, sex work is kind of a concept, like the actual people who are on the receiving end of those statements and those laws in that position from the government are sex workers themselves, right? So to put it bluntly, she said, nobody cares, the state doesn't care, and it's reflected in these laws, and it's reflected in the position they adopted in this court case.
Another group of interveners, the Women's Coalition Against Prostitution, gave a press conference in Vancouver shortly before they testified before the Supreme Court.
My name is Tricia Bapti. I was involved in prostitution for 15 years, from the ages of 13 to 28. I founded an organization called EVE, which stands for Formerly Exploited Voices, Now Educating. And we are all former sex industry women who challenge the idea of sex as work and who view it as violence against women. We at EVE know prostitution is not inevitable. Prostitution is born out of many systemic issues like poverty, racism, colonialism, addiction, and many other challenges women and girls face. We know that the violence women suffer in prostitution will not go away if you remove the laws surrounding prostitution. In fact, the violence will increase as the men who perpetrate the violence will face no legal barriers to their abusive behavior.
The issue of colonialism was argued from many perspectives around the case. Here is an indigenous speaker from the Sex Workers National Day of Action rally.
My name is Krista. I spoke to you in my ancestral language, my Lenape language. The Native Youth Sexual Health Network is a cross Canada and the United States organization. We work on anything and everything to do with sexual and reproductive health, rights, and justice by and for self-identified Indigenous youth. And I just wanted to remind everybody and acknowledge Mississaugas of the New Credit on whose land we're on today. I'm also a guest. There are original law. There is natural law here that has nothing to do with the colonial law system that came in later and made things like sex work and abortion and a whole bunch of other things illegal on purpose. It was done on purpose to undermine the sovereignty and self-determination of Indigenous peoples. And that is the foundation on which our organizing starts, right? We need to understand how all of these things became illegal in the first place if we're going to have a really solid analysis going forward and a path forward. And we know that Aboriginal sex workers have been at the heart and the space of this movement for a long, long time. And I'm just really honored to be here as an ally and as a friend.
Other Indigenous women argued that colonialism is not only the cause of prostitution laws, but of prostitution itself. The Native Women's Association of Canada is of that opinion. So is Summer Rain from the Women's Coalition Against Prostitution.
My name is Summer Rain, and I'm Coast Salish from the Squamish Nation. I work at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter. From our frontline work over the last 40 years as a Rape Crisis Center, we know that there is an overrepresentation of Aboriginal women and girls in street-level prostitution in Vancouver and around the world. Prostitution is inherently violent and racist. In Vancouver, Asian women are hidden and overrepresented in indoor prostitution, such as brothels and massage parlors. Prostitution exists as a last-ditch survival strategy, not a free choice, and is never a choice a child should have to make. In Canada, the average age of entry into prostitution is between the ages of 12 to 14 years old. Prostitution is not what we want for ourselves, our mothers, grandmothers, aunties, sisters, or daughters.
The Supreme Court's announcement of its judgment was unanimous and stated that all the prostitution laws that were challenged put the safety and lives of prostitutes at risk, which is unconstitutional. However, all the laws remain in effect for another year, so that Parliament will have a chance to pass new laws. Fred Chatbot has strong opinions about such delays.
Personally, I find it really upsetting that it takes so long and the laws are stayed in the meantime because it's going to affect so many people's lives. These laws contribute to so much violence experienced by sex workers, especially street-based sex workers, that for me it's on the offensive side that we're keeping these laws in the meantime when there's so much evidence that shows they contribute to the violence and the vulnerability to violence.
During this next year, there is sure to be much discussion about prostitution laws. Amy Lebovich, a plaintiff in the case, would like to see sex workers leading in a discussion about what the new laws should look like, and she looks to international models.
What they've done in New South Wales, Australia, and New Zealand is rational and regulation that makes sense and that people come to a consensus about, right? Sex workers being at the forefront of that discussion and is a step in the right direction as far as also the discussion around that this is a choice for a lot of people and breaks down sort of the barriers that people have in their mind about what sex work and sex workers are.
It is not at all certain the Supreme Court decision will now result in the changes the plaintiffs were seeking. According to reporter Daphne Bramham of the Vancouver Sun, the conservative-controlled parliament seems unlikely to either legalize or decriminalize prostitution. One prospect she sees could be a blanket law simply outlawing prostitution in all its forms. Or another choice might be the so-called Nordic model, in which selling sex is legal, but buying it is illegal. Conservative MP Joy Smith issued a press release the day of the Supreme Court decision, calling for that solution. It is also the favored model of the Women's Coalition Against Prostitution, but they don't see the Conservative Party as an ally.
The true version of the Nordic model is not just legislation that's criminalizing men, but it's also providing genuine economic opportunities for women. And unfortunately, the Conservative government has done very little for women in regard to women's poverty in particular. So if there is a will, there is a way, but so far we have very little hopes from the Conservative government. And really, a law that tackled prostitution as an issue of women's inequality would be better proposed by all parties combining forces to support women to be provided with alternatives that will prevent them being vulnerable to prostitution to begin with.
And that was Hilla Kerner, a frontline worker at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter in Vancouver, ending our coverage of the Bedford versus Canada Supreme Court decision.
Resonating reconciliation. Resonate. To send out. Waves of energy ringing outward. Reconcile, to make amends, find solutions, and resolution.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada has scheduled its last national public event for Edmonton, Alberta, March 27th to 30th, 2014. Among the activities it has funded since its inception is a series of 40 radio programs titled Resonating Reconciliation, covering the experiences of Native residential school survivors and their descendants. 25 of these programs were produced in 2013 under the management of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Like many other people in our community, it affected all our family members. Our older brothers and sisters came home with different behaviors. I didn't see it till later on in life when there were parents and their kids were the same age as me. They had a strict way of being with us, and religion seemed to be a big part of their world, and they tried to instill those beliefs in us, and we didn't understand why.
Well, it impacted my life through being raised with a residential school survivor. My father was in there, and my uncles. You know, just growing up, it was different because my father was really strict. Yeah, I got quite a few beatings because of it, and I knew that that wasn't my father that was doing that. That was just what happened to him when he was growing up, so.
You just heard an excerpt from a program titled The Effects of Indian Residential Schools, produced by Janet Rogers of CFUV Radio in Victoria, B.C. You can hear all the Resonating Reconciliation programs by visiting the website ncra.ca and clicking on the link Resonating Reconciliation. Another 15 programs will be created by Aboriginal producers at community radio stations in early 2014.
Almost 160 years since the signing of the treaty, you know, and all these things that were guaranteed in there, the education, the health, the housing, oh, and much more that was guaranteed to our people back then. And back then there was a huge language barrier and the misconceptions of money, because we didn't have money in the old days when our elders, our great grandparents, you know, it's something that a lot of these things have to be known to the mainstream.
This year-end edition of Groundwire was produced at CJSF FM Burnaby, BC by Selena Wall and Frieda Worden, with help from the Groundwire coordinator, Carly Forbes. Groundwire is the national news program of Campus and Community Radio in Canada. To submit or suggest stories from your community for Groundwire, email groundwireprod@gmail.com.